Willkommen zum Hi-Podcast mit Sophie Ronschka und Christoph Käse.
Guten Morgen, Sophie. Hallo.
Guten Morgen, Christoph. Heute wollen wir mal ohne viel Gerede direkt in die zweite Folge unserer Doppelfolge zur Kernfusion springen. Wer erst jetzt einschaltet, Sie können direkt weiterhören. Man kann diese Folge auch verstehen, ohne die erste gehört zu haben, aber vielleicht wollen Sie danach ja doch noch einmal die Folge der vergangenen Woche nachhören.
Das glaube ich übrigens auch. Man kann beide Folgen unabhängig voneinander hören. Unser Gast, der kann einfach unglaublich gut erklären.
Nochmal kurz zur Erinnerung, wovon die beiden Folgen eigentlich gehandelt haben oder handeln werden. In der ersten Ausgabe, also in der vergangenen Woche, beschäftigen wir uns mit den physikalischen Grundlagen. Worum geht es bei der Kernfusion eigentlich? Wodurch unterscheidet sie sich von der Kernspaltung? Warum verspricht sie so viel mehr Heil und Segen als die Spaltung von Atomkernen? Und was passiert da eigentlich genau im Detail? Und in der zweiten Folge, also heute, geht es dann darum, wie Kernfusion kommerziell nutzbar gemacht werden könnte und wie unsere Energieversorgung dann aussehen würde, wenn großtechnische Nutzung wirklich möglich wäre. Sind dann wirklich alle unsere Energiesorgen behoben? Welche Auswirkungen hätte das auf Politik, Geopolitik und Gesellschaft? Also dazu mehr in dieser Folge.
So ist es. Starten wir in diese Folge.
Genau, und zwar mit einem ganz besonderen Gast. Und für alle, die ihn vergangene Woche verpasst haben, stellen wir ihn noch einmal ganz kurz vor.
Der Hi-Podcast mit Sophie Ronschka und Christoph Käse. Unser Gast heute ist
Leben Koblenz.
Leben Koblenz ist einer der führenden Köpfe von ITER, dem internationalen Großforschungsprojekt zur Kernfusion. ITER sitzt in Südfrankreich in der Nähe von Aix-en-Provence. Dort entsteht der größte, teuerste und anspruchsvollste Kernfusionsreaktor der Welt. Aufgaben des internationalen Großprojekts ist es, die wissenschaftliche und ingenieurtechnische Herausforderung der Kernfusion zu erschließen, um der Menschheit diese Energieform zugänglich zu machen. ITER ist eine Art CERN für Kernfusion, bloß mit einem größeren Fokus auf praktische Umsetzung. Leben Koblenz vertritt ITER nach außen. Aus den USA stammend hat er sich sein Leben lang mit Wissenschaft und Energiegewinnung beschäftigt. Er hat für die US-Aufsichtsbehörde für Kernenergie gearbeitet, ebenso wie für den US-Senat und die Internationale Atomenergiekommission. Schon seit September 2016 ist er bei ITER. Er kennt jede wissenschaftliche Debatte, jede ingenieurtechnische Herausforderung und jedes Startup auf dem Gebiet der Kernfusion. Und er ist ein begnadeter Erklärer und Ausdeuter von Wissenschaft. Hören wir, was ihr besprochen habt.
Leben, good to have you again.
Thank you, Christoph, for having me again.
So last week, we explored the basic signs of nuclear fusion. This week, we're going to talk about what a world would look like if nuclear fusion works. So let's suppose we would come to a workable, commercially feasible fusion reactor. What kind of energy price would we be looking at?
It's hard to determine that with accuracy, but I would say the following goes into the finance. Fusion would be something where you would have a large initial capital cost, a very, very negligible fuel cost, a minimal in relation certainly to fission or in relation to fossil fuels where we throw our waste directly into the atmosphere and start climate change. Fusion would have a very minimal waste cost. And so when you take all those costs together, it should be highly competitive with your best cents per kilowatt hour charge of any energy source out there.
So let's talk about byproducts. So there's very little radioactive waste. Is there, or is there any?
Sure, there is waste, but there's not going to be, if you choose your materials correctly, for fusion, what you will not have is any long-term highly radioactive waste. The neutrons that convey the heat that allow you to harness fusion, over time, they make the steel itself, the actual device, the physical device, radioactive. But it's short-term, and the tritium that comes out is also short-term. So what you would end up with is a device that really, if you left it in place for, say, 100 years, you could just recycle it. It is not anything like the waste hazards of nuclear fission.
Okay. And the machine, as far as I have understood it, cannot explode, right? Why is that? Why can it kind of not blow up, not create a China syndrome, not create a Chernobyl?
So a couple of reasons, but I need to give the contrast with what happens in fission. In fission, you have a chain reaction where you don't only get energy coming out, but you get more neutrons coming out of the fission reaction that cause more fission. So it is a chain reaction. And the term that nuclear fission people use is you maintain that critical, meaning you maintain it at a level where it's just enough and not too much. If it's not enough, if it's subcritical, nothing happens. You don't get energy. If it's supercritical, you better quickly bring it back to critical, or you have a runaway like a Chernobyl or whatever. And what you have as a moderator for that physics, for that fission reaction, is water. And if that water turns to steam, it creates pressure that can create an explosion. So the standards, the safety standards of a fission reactor are for a pressure vessel, meaning that if you don't control it, it explodes outward. You have a steam explosion. So in a fusion device, a tokamak or a stellarator type of fusion reactor, what you have is actually a vacuum vessel. So to make this operate, it operates at vacuum conditions. If something went wrong with the machine, it would implode, not explode. Secondly, there's no chain reaction. So what you're struggling to do with fusion is to maintain the pulse as long as possible. Because there's no chain reaction, if something happens, something goes wrong, what will happen is it shuts down instantly. There is no buildup of heat that needs to go somewhere. There is a very high temperature, but that temperature is only involving 2 to 3 grams of material that's behaving in a particularly controlled way in a magnetic field. And so you stop it, it stops instantly. That is the physics of fusion.
And when it comes to the purchase of fuel, all fuels we're using today exercise or create some geopolitical problems. Uranium, we were used to be getting from Russia. Oil, we are acquiring from all kinds of complicated, sometimes rogue states in the Middle East or in the Far East. Where would we be getting the fuel for fusion?
From water. Now, this is an enormous point that you raise, Christoph, because when I gave you the answer about what would the price of fusion-produced electricity be like, I neglected this particular factor. And I'll tell you why. When you are when the government or the utilities in Germany or in any country are setting the price for electricity, they are not required to calculate the cost of waste, meaning the fossil fuels we put into the atmosphere. They're also not required to calculate the cost of war. If you go back through the last 120 years, do this exercise. Try to find a major war that did not in some way calculate proximity to fossil fuel, to petroleum reserves. This has been a factor that is never calculated into the price of our energy, and yet alignment with, as you said, not only the good states, but the bad states sometimes that are even rogue actors, but we want to be aligned with them for one reason, because they have huge oil deposits. Fusion takes its fuel from water and the Earth's crust, which means that it is equally available to all nations of the world. From water, you get deuterium, and from water or the Earth's crust, you can get lithium, which is how we make tritium. You put tritium in the wall, you put lithium in the walls of your reactor so that that neutron that hits the fusion wall, that neutron will convert the lithium into a tritium, which you then extract and recycle to use as your fuel. So the geopolitics of fusion, if we can make this work, changes the equation for peace. Human nature being what it is, maybe we find something else to fight about. But the geopolitics of petroleum would go away.
Now, this leads to another point. Looking at the Earth from the outside, it's a blue planet because of all this water. But yet, we're lacking water all over the place. Sahara is only explainable by the lack of water. If water were abundantly available, not salty water, but clean water, we could reforest a Sahara, plant tomatoes, bananas, a jungle, whatever. It's all a question of lack of water. And there's been a lot of fighting about petroleum, but probably just as much fighting about water. Now, if there were such a source like fusion energy, clean, available for everybody, then we could, at a very large scale, desalinate water. So is it fair to say that breaking through to fusion would also mean breaking kind of the barriers of water scarcity?
Sure. It's yet another aspect. The electricity from fusion could be used in four or five different ways that have huge impacts for a green planet. One is, as you said, fusion could be used for desalination. So yes, you could split water to make clean seawater to take out the salt, and therefore you would have more abundant fresh water. You can also use fusion as a heat source, as a direct heating source. You could use fusion as the intensity of when we make steel or concrete. Nearly all the steel and concrete you've ever seen incorporated into buildings or structures that we use on a daily basis comes from petroleum-intensive processes. So fusion can provide the intensive heat that would be needed to scale up the exercise of the manufacture of steel and concrete. It could also be used to produce hydrogen. Hydrogen is another clean fuel, but it is not, contrary to what most people think, hydrogen does not exist purely in nature. It's normally in a form of water or something else where you need to make the hydrogen. Now, once you make the hydrogen, it burns very cleanly as a power source. So you could have hydrogen fuel cells, for example, powering jet airplanes or powering super tankers that bring goods from one place to another in a green way. So there are multiple ways in which an abundant fusion energy source could be harnessed to make other things that fuel our lifestyles green.
Mm-hmm. Now, this sounds almost too good to be true. And to my feeling, much of the skepticism about fusion comes from kind of two general ideas. One idea is we have been promised fusion over the past 30 years and never happened. So it will probably be another 30 years out. So it's always 30-year out argument. And the other is we've never seen any silver bullet in the world. It simply doesn't exist, right? So every technology that we were promised bore some disadvantage which we were not aware of when we first invented it. So when radioactivity was discovered, by the way, here in Berlin, close to where I live, mm-hmm. radium became the material of the hour.
Exactly.
And people thought they could get a rheuma and other diseases by exposing themselves to radium. It was a terrible, terrible mistake. And we learned over time that technologies are almost never as good as we would have thought, but rather much more complicated, with for a long time the disadvantages over or outweighing the advantages. So when we talk about all these potential advantages of fusion energy, what are we missing in that equation? Where is kind of the drawback? Where are the strings attached?
Well, I think I give you three answers. The strings attached are always going to be there in human nature. And no matter what clean energy source we manage to come up with, or any other technology, artificial intelligence, you know, we look at this as something that can be used for great good. But of course, if you have an abundance of energy, you can use that energy for negative purposes. So even if we solve this geopolitical conflict over petroleum by harnessing successfully fusion as an energy source, we will still probably find other things to fight wars over. And if we fight and we have more energy to fuel those wars, then arguably that's a negative. But I would say that remarkably, in 50, 60 years of research on fusion, we've not discovered any negative effect coming from the fusion reaction itself. It's simply that it's very difficult to harness. So it's the engineering challenges that we want to get to. And I would say, you know, the way I had always heard of fusion was that it was always going to be 50 years away. Ha, ha, ha. And then about 8 years ago, I joined ITER. And we started showing real progress. And these private sector companies, of which at that time, I think there were about five, we started seeing some interest that as we proved that you could manufacture fusion components with large enough specification and a small enough precision, we started seeing the private sector investors building up. And so now we've got something like latest count, I think 43 private sector fusion initiatives. And the investors are not stupid. So during that period, I started hearing people saying that fusion was always going to be 30 years away. And I smiled and I thought, well, that's better than 50. And last year, last fall, I had a journalist who said, so what do you make of this statement that fusion is always 10 years away? And I laughed out loud because I thought, you know, we're getting better with our estimates. And I think the investors, while not all of these private sector devices certainly will succeed, we hope that some will. And the investors involved are not stupid. They understand the magnitude of the transformation they could bring, this could bring really for our society.
And Lehman, how would, with the private sector evolving, state finance initiative like yours would collaborate with private sector? So is it like NASA declaring that space is not only NASA, but also private companies are welcome to come in, like Blue Origin or Richard Branson or SpaceX? So them giving way to private initiatives and opening a market, that wrote that they have paved themselves, but then as it has been paved already, is now open for private initiatives? Or what would be the role of ITER in a world where private money keeps pouring in?
So I think it's a very, very timely question that you're asking here, because just in November of 2023, our oversight body, the ITER Council, took a decision that some of us had been hoping for, working on for quite a long time, but it still seemed like a massive breakthrough, where the council actually said, in its very bureaucratic wording record of decision, that ITER, they're calling on ITER, they're requesting ITER to engage with the private sector fusion initiatives. And what does that mean? What it means is, as I said, ITER is the Convergent National Lab. We will always be relevant because we can change out materials, do different experiments, et cetera, et cetera. The private sector isn't going to build a machine of that cost and that scale as an experiment. They want to build something that is one step, then another step, then another step toward a fusion device, toward a commercial device. So they will be minimizing those kinds of costs and actually taking greater risks, because it's okay if their machine burns up in its first run. It's no big deal as long as they gain the knowledge to build the next machine. So ideally, optimally, those private sector and public sector initiatives should be working in parallel. In Germany, you have Wendelstein 7X, which is this stellarator, a publicly funded, taxpayer-funded European stellarator that is now starting to work with two other stellarators that are private sector startups, Proxima and Gauss. Both early stage stellarators that are working on a similar way forward. So what ITER is doing, what Wendelstein 7X is doing, what others are doing is saying the purpose of taxpayer money for these devices was not to just, it's not like CERN where it's purely scientific research. There was always supposed to be a practical outcome to ITER, which is what we call technology transfer. And that's really part of our original mission, will be to hopefully share this information with the private sector. And we're already launching initiatives to do that.
Very last question, Lehman. Thank you. In a future world, if it works, what will be the topography of fusion production? So will it be one huge reactor for all of Germany or one for all of Europe? Or will it be local ones for one part of town? Or will it be a block generator just down the road heating or providing electricity for 50 buildings? So what is the most likely topography of a fusion power creation system?
I'll tell you the world that I would envision, because that will depend on utility choices and many, many other kinds of choices. But I would like to see fusion running in parallel with renewables. So you have this decentralization in Germany, the Energiewende that has been idealized as, you know, having solar panels everywhere and so forth. That's actually a very, very smart idea for decentralized, like household use, for small industrial use. It could do to some extent. Where fusion comes in is where you have these mega cities, or where you have big industry, like Germany has in many fields. that is where it's very difficult to get away from petroleum when we need a substitute. So the beauty of fusion, because of its safety factor, is that theoretically you could put it quite close to a city. You can right now, we would put a petroleum plant or a nuclear plant or a big, any sort of big plant, we put it a distance from a city, and then we run power lines and we lose a lot of electricity in that power line. So theoretically with fusion, you could put it much closer to where you wanted the energy to be stored. So if you look at a town like Frankfurt, say, or Paris or something of that sort, you're probably right now using roughly, say, on the order of six gigawatts of electricity. So a normal large power plant is in the range of 1 gigawatt. So that would be 6 plants to power Frankfurt, say something like that. But think about the uses. And this makes a big, big change now, because right now for most countries, electricity is only about the end use of about 35% of our energy consumption. We use very different, we use gasoline in our cars or diesel. We use petroleum in our ocean-going vessels, etc. So if now you wanted to use clean output, say hydrogen as a fuel or electricity as your fuel, and all your cars were electric or all of your airplanes were hydrogen fuel cells, then you need a lot more of fusion electricity. So to be smart, if Frankfurt wanted to have just 6 gigawatts, or say they wanted to have everything electrical in Frankfurt, so now they wanted to have maybe 15 gigawatts, yes, they could build one 15-gigawatt fusion plant, but it wouldn't be the smartest approach, because anytime that you have downtime or you're going to change something out, then you have no electricity. So you'd be smarter to build, say, my thinking would be ideally a fusion plant of around 2.5 gigawatts with the consumption by the electricity on the plant. The support systems may be 500. So a net 2-gigawatt fusion plant. And for a Frankfurt, you would have maybe 3 of those. So if we wanted to go full electric, you'd have 6 of those. You could build bigger, but that's probably the smart way. And then you, at that size, you could position them closest to where they would be used.
That is an interesting and fascinating vision, Leben. Thank you very much for explaining this technology and its future and potential in such a vivid and understandable way. Much appreciated. And thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Christoph. Thank you for having me.
Und was schreibt ihr euch diese Woche auf den Merkzettel?
Ich nehme aus dieser zweiten Folge mit. Mit Kernfusion könnte es gelingen, den heute knappen Stoff Energie zu einem Überflussgut zu verwandeln. Dann würde es Energie in Hülle und Fülle geben. Das klingt jetzt erstmal wie ein Traum, aber auch diese Hülle und Fülle würde eigene Probleme mit sich bringen. Zum Beispiel in der Form, dass letztendlich auch Kriege mit Energie als knappes Gut auskommen müssen. Und umso gewalttätiger werden könnten, je mehr preisgünstige Energie es gibt. Allerdings könnten wir diese negativen Auswirkungen in den Griff bekommen. Im Vordergrund stehen aber auf jeden Fall die positiven Auswirkungen. Plötzlich gibt es auf der Welt überall reichlich Wasser und wir könnten Wüsten in Urwälder und Tomatenfelder verwandeln.
Und ich nehme mit, erstens, es würde sich ändern die Topografie der Energieversorgung. Wenn wir von oben auf die Landkarte schauen und gucken, wo stehen unsere großen Kraftwerke und wie groß sind diese Kraftwerke eigentlich, das alles würde sich ändern. Es könnte sein, dass mehr dezentrale Kraftwerke verstehen, aber trotzdem, wir haben es am Beispiel Frankfurt gerade von Leben Koblenz gehört, könnte so sein, dass auch große Anlagen da stehen, vielleicht 6 an der Zahl für eine Stadt wie Frankfurt, die dann diesen ganzen Großraum mit verlässlicher, sauberer Energie als Grundlastversorger versorgen. Zweitens, ganz wichtig, der geopolitische Aspekt. Wir lösen uns aus unserer Abhängigkeit von Diktaturen. Die meisten Kriege des vergangenen Jahrhunderts und auch dieses Jahrhunderts werden geführt rund um das Thema Energie und manchmal auch um Wasser. Diese Kriege, die würden der Vergangenheit angehören, weil Energie plötzlich kein knappes Gut mehr ist. Und das führt drittens zu der bemerkenswerten Erkenntnis, dass der Brennstoff für diese Kernfusionsanlagen überall verfügbar ist. Man kann Deuterium und Tritium tatsächlich aus normalem Meerwasser, aus Trinkwasser erzeugen. Man muss sie in gewisser Weise schwerer machen, anreichern. Das ist bei dem einen Element Tritium etwas schwerer als bei Deuterium, das haben wir gehört. Aber trotzdem, es bleibt beim Rohstoff Wasser. Und das gibt es überall ziemlich gleich verteilt auf der Welt. Und da, wo es es nicht gibt, zum Beispiel der Sahara, kann man es ziemlich einfach mit Pipelines transportieren. Man braucht noch nicht mal Pipelines, es reichen wahrscheinlich ganz einfache Tankwagen, das haben wir auch gehört. Denn ein kleines Gläschen voll mit Wasser, das enthält viel mehr Energie als ganze Tonnenladungen von Kohle. Und das war's mit unserer Doppelfolge zur Kernfusion.
Ja, da sollten jetzt wirklich alle Fragen geklärt sein und wir freuen uns natürlich schon auf das Thema in der nächsten Woche, oder?
Das tun wir. Wir hören uns wieder in der kommenden Woche und zwar am Dienstagmorgen um
5.55 Uhr. Bis dahin, ciao.
Ciao, tschüss.
Das war der HiPodcast für diese Woche. Wenn Sie keine Folge verpassen möchten, immer dienstags um 5.55 Uhr kommen wir heraus. Versprochen. Mögen Sie uns? Dann abonnieren Sie uns jetzt oder hinterlassen Sie einen Like. Wir freuen uns über Anregungen, Kritik und Wünsche. Schreiben Sie uns gerne an podcast@hi.co. Nicht .com, sondern .co. Eine Produktion der Axel Springer HI GmbH, einer führenden Beratung für Strategie und Umsetzung neuer Geschäftsmodelle. Wir engagieren uns leidenschaftlich für das Wachstum Ihres Unternehmens.